still live in the sticks where you wouldn't go. In a town of 1200 off an old dirt road. And a country boy is all I'll ever be.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Shooter's Apprentice podcast. Hoping everybody is doing really well this week. We've been pretty busy here at the cabin trying to get everything ready, for me to head back to work. This time I'm hoping with this new job I shouldn't be gone for more than a few days, maybe a week at a time this time. But I still want to, you know, I want to make sure there's plenty of firewood ready, and as well as a few other things that are needed to get, you know, I need to get it done to the house to make sure it's better for winter. So like today, I spent all day under the house trying to, you know, I was working on replacing some of the insulation when we, you know, built the place 5 years ago, and it was November and we were trying to get moved in. I just kind of stuffed insulation up into the floor and it was on faced R30, and I was pulling some of that out and replacing it with R30 with R15 underneath that and stapling it in and just trying to get it all a little more secure and redone a little better, hold heat a little better. And then, you know, like this week, I split and cut and split about 2 cords of firewood and got it all stacked, and I still need to do quite a bit more firewood, but that should get us by for a while. So, real quick, I wanted to apologize for last week. When I went and did the editing on last week's episode, I realized that I'd been kind of talking a little bit too fast during the recording, and the entire recording just kind of sounded mumbled a little bit. So I'm doing something different with the microphone. I'm trying to remind myself to, you know, force myself to slow down a little bit when I'm speaking. And then I've actually got my microphone set up completely different this week. I'm trying something to see how the audio quality is. You guys will have to send me a message or an email and let me know if it sounds better or not. But I'm trying something different. And if this works, I ordered a few parts to kind of make the audio quality a little bit better. So we'll see how that goes. So, so earlier this week, I sold the trailer, and we'll talk, I'll talk about that again in the main part of the podcast, but I had to go to Fairbanks and drop it off, and I went to Costco, and, just to get some, you know, stuff. Every time we go up there, we get, you know, whatever, groceries we need. We don't have a grocery store here in Delta. The roof caved in on the one we had, like, 3 years ago now. They haven't built another grocery store here, so we don't have a grocery store. The closest grocery store is 100 miles, so... Well, whenever we have to go up there for anything, we get groceries and stock up. So I had to go up there and drop that trailer off the other day when I sold it. And when I went to Costco, they had turkeys on sale for 99 cents a pound, which it's unheard of up here. So I grabbed 4 of them. They're all about 20-pound turkeys. And today, before I started recording this podcast, I smoked one this morning. So I brined it. This is the way I pretty much always do turkeys. I brine them for about 24 hours, fast cock, and I smoke them. This one, being a 20-pound turkey, it smoked for right around 4 hours, and man, it turned out really good. It's probably the best turkey I've made in a while. Turkey is probably Amanda's favorite protein, so we just decided to go ahead and cook up one of these birds I just bought last week instead of refreezing all 4 of them for later, you know, because they were thawed out at Costco. You know, they're getting ready for... Thanksgiving, so they were all thawed out and sitting there in the rack. So instead of freezing all 4 of them, we went ahead and cooked 1 of them. And I wish I had picked up about 10 of them at that price, but you know, it's too late now. You know, it is what it is. But in the meantime, I'm sitting here recording this show and I'm feeling just a little bit sleepy with a belly full of turkey and mashed potatoes and all the good stuff that we kind of made, like, a, I wouldn't call it a full Thanksgiving dinner, but kind of a micro Thanksgiving dinner. It was really good. And then, since I'm recording in the cabin today, because it's down right now, I'm looking at the thermometer, it's 6 degrees outside. And so the temp's dropping. I just didn't feel like trying to get the camper warmed up enough to work in. You know what? The only way I can really get that thing warm enough to be able to work in without gloves and that kind of stuff is to run the propane heaters, get up the temp. And then I have so long, I can turn all that off because they're really loud and they turn up on the audio really bad, so I have a certain amount of time to get what I need done, you know, before it gets too cold in there and I have to, you know, heat it up again and all that kind of stuff. So it takes a lot of propane. It's just kind of a pain. So we're recording inside today. We're sitting next to the wood stove where it's nice and warm, and so I'm not gonna be smoking a cigar on the show this week. I don't smoke in the house, but I am sitting here and I'm sipping on a glass of whiskey with on the rocks while I record. And this is actually some more of that Crown Peach that I was drinking a couple episodes back because it's sitting on the shelf and I need to get it drank up to make more room on the shelf because I'm running out of room for the whiskey that I do enjoy. This isn't bad whiskey. You know, I like peach flavored things and I don't hate Crown. It's not a bad whiskey, so it's pretty decent. All right, before we go any further, I want to go on just kind of a little mini rant real here. We're gonna derail or go off the road and just kind of go on a little mini rant right here real quick. And then we will move on. It's just something that was, you know, the other day, it was just kind of grinding my gears, and it's been kind of just bothering me in the back of my head for the last couple days. So I'm gonna go ahead and rant about it real quick, and then we will move on to the main part of the show. So have you ever had any ammo that was just crap, but you don't want to throw it away, but you can't, you know, you should just throw it away, but you just can't bring yourself to do it? And this is actually like my second time facing this dilemma. The first time was with some older Canadian 22 ammo that I had picked up, and this ammo would split at the rim almost every shot, and it spit gas out of the action. And I ended up throwing about 400 rounds of this away. You know, I tried to shoot about 100 rounds of it out of various guns, and it was really bad. It was, you know, it didn't matter what you shot it out of, it gas would leak out of the action. So I ended up throwing about 400 rounds of that stuff away rather than damage one of my guns or get, you know, burned powder in my face or whatever. It wasn't as bad shooting pistols, but like I blew the extractor off of one semi-auto pistol when one of the cases split. It was just garbage, you know. And the bad thing was, actually, I shot the ammo out of my CZ, or my Zastava Model 99, and it was like the most accurate 22 ammo that I tested through that gun. But I just couldn't deal with the rim splitting every time. So this time, it was, once again, it was 22 ammo, but I started out with about 3,000 rounds of it this time instead of just a single brick. And I've gotten to the point where I just will not buy Winchester ammo anymore. But a while back, about the time I got back into shooting 22s a little bit, when 22 ammo became available again, I bought several thousand rounds of Winchester 22 ammo because I needed some. You know, I didn't have any 22 ammo, and it was still a little hard to find. So when this stuff came available, I bought, you know, several bricks and boxes of it. And this stuff, you know, it's in different kinds of boxes. You know, like I got some that are, I got about 800 rounds, 1,000 rounds that are in like the red slip top 100 round, you know, the 100 round boxes. And then I've got bricks and that are like 333 round or 555 round, like bulk bricks. But it's all pretty much the same ammo. You know, some of it says 36 grain, some of it says 40 grain, but it's all plated hollow point, high velocity. The ammo looks exactly the same. And this stuff, it's just absolute crap. No matter which source it comes from, if it's from the red boxes, the red 100 round boxes actually seem to be the worst. You know, like the other day I was out shooting plinking with the Super Wrangler, and I was just out in the backyard plinking at an empty can, you know, avoiding my adult responsibilities and shooting a gun like I like to do sometimes. And it was like at least once per cylinder I had to stop, pull the cylinder out and check and make sure I didn't have a bullet stuck in the barrel, because it would just be like bang, bang, and like there'd be like one time like I watched a bullet like fall out of the end of the barrel and hit the ground like 10 feet in front of me. Like it was just crap. You know, every round sounds different. You know, a few of them, like they sounded and recoiled way harder and heavier than like almost like a shooting a 22 mag from that little revolver. You know, it just, needless to say, this ammo, it's just been a pain. You know, even just for plinking, it's horribly inaccurate, you know, with massive vertical stringing. But I've still got like 2,000 rounds of this stuff left, and it hurts me to think about throwing away that much 22 ammo. You know, because and when I bought it, prices were up, you know, like the 100 round box has like $16 on it or something like that. But, you know, it can't really be used in an autoloader. I mean, you can, but the lack of power in most of the rounds, they won't cycle an autoloader, and you're dealing with stovepipes and jams, and it's just, I should just throw this stuff in the trash and shoot the good ammo I have. I have lots of good 22 ammo now, but I just can't bring myself to do it. So every once in a while, I go out and torture myself by shooting, you know, 40 or 50 rounds of this crap. And it's just, ugh. So All right. Okay. Rant over. We'll bring you back to your regularly scheduled program. So, I wasn't really sure what I was going to talk about today. I thought about talking, you know, about my thoughts on the most practical or the most versatile revolver cartridge, but I know that my thoughts on that subject are going to, you know, they're going to stir and open up a can of worms because I have kind of controversial thoughts as far as the practical revolver cartridges, especially for single actions. And I'm gonna do that one of these days. I'm gonna open that can of worms, but just I didn't want to do it today. You know, and I was thinking about maybe doing an episode on the Rossi 454 carbine, but I still haven't really shot that rifle enough to really get my, you know, complete thoughts about it. You know, I've shot a couple boxes out of it, and I had one before, and I liked the gun a lot, but I just need a little bit more time to kind of put something together for that one. You know, and I had a couple other ideas, but, you know, today's subject, it actually kind of just fell into my lap this week. And, you know, it's one of those things, like, I know a little bit about this subject just from, you know, reading books and being a gun guy and whatever. But the last few days I've been, you know, I've just been kind of cramming, like, for, you know, studying and just trying to cram all this information in my head. So while it might not be the most informative episode, this stuff's all kind of fresh in my head, I still think it'll be a good episode, especially for the guys who like the older military surplus stuff. So as I mentioned earlier, I had to go to Fairbanks earlier this week to sell that trailer, you know, and over the summer I'd bought a new 14K, you know, a 14,000 pound equipment trailer, and I bought that over the summer, and that got me up to, I had 3 20-foot trailers here, and I just didn't need that many trailers. So I had a 10,000 pound deck over that I almost never used. It sat real high up off the ground. It was a tandem axle, and it just, you know, I didn't use it a whole lot. So I ended up selling it, you know, right after I bought the new trailer. But it took me a while to decide, to make up my mind to go ahead and sell the other trailer I had, which was a triple axle. It's also a 10K because they were only 3,500 pound axles under that one, but it was a triple axle, and I built this trailer like from scratch when we first moved back up here, you know, out of materials I could get my hands on for cheap. And it was a great trailer, you know, I hauled skid steers on it and all that kind of stuff, but it was just a little bit too narrow for, like, hauling, you know, mid-sized equipment, or like my plow truck, when I had to haul it up for the transmission rebuild, it wouldn't fit on that trailer, which is actually when I bought the new one. And yeah, so it just, you know, I didn't need two trailers. I hadn't used the one I built since I bought the new trailer. They're virtually identical trailer, 20 foot, except that the new one is wider and it has two axles that actually have a higher load rating. So anyway, since I had to run to Fairbanks to deliver the trailer I sold, I did what I always do when I'm turned loose in the city on supervised, and I went to the gun shops and I went into my favorite. And was looking around, and I noticed that this rifle was still on the rack. And I've eyeballed it a few times. It's been there for a while. And so this time I went ahead and made an offer on it, and they accepted. And this rifle that caught my eye and kind of led me down the road of temptation is a sporterized Type 99 Japanese Arisaka rifle. And I haven't seen very many sporters done on these or any of the other Jap rifles. You know, and this one, it's a very nicely done rifle. And, you know, since it's a little bit odd and I like weird guns, it just kind of called to me. And I ended up picking it up. I gave $350 for it. And this rifle has a very nice Mannlicher stock on it. Beautiful bluing, peep sights. It actually fits the criteria for a scout rifle because it weighs right at 6.6 pounds. It has a 19-inch barrel, and it's 38.5 inches overall, so it's under the 3 meters long, 39 inches long. You know, it doesn't have the forward-mounted scope, and it's not 308. But, you know, it's a super handy little rifle, and it fits me really well, partly due to the stock having been built for a left-handed shooter. And I was able to acquire 4 boxes of Bannerman brand ammo, which I'd never heard of. And I'm not 100% convinced that this is not just reboxed Privy ammo, but I have no way of proving that. So Anyway, I was aware that the Japanese rifles have existed. I've never owned one, but I've never really studied about them that much. I remember my dad had some type of Japanese rifle and 6.5 Jap when I was a kid. I think it was a Type 38, but I don't remember. And I was, you know, that's about the extent of my experience with these rifles. And then due to the last ditch war rifle, the World War II, I think the Jap rifles, they kind of got a bad reputation. And it's just not that common to see sporty rifles built on them. And you know, when they do pop up, they're usually just plain cut down military stock with maybe like a peep sight thrown on them. They're not, you know, really nicely redone rifles like this one. But they are actually a very strong action that is similar to a Mauser, and they, when they designed them, they were, you know, they took, you know, characteristics of both the Mauser and Mannlicher rifles. You know, and the safety on these Jap rifles, it's kind of neat, and it actually works pretty slick by pushing in. There's like a chrysanthemum or whatever on the back. There's a design on the back. There's a big knurled knob on the back of the bolt, and you just push that in and turn it clockwise, and that engages the safety in it, and it also locks up the action. And then to disengage it, just push it in and rotate it counterclockwise to, you know, turn the safety off. You know, and so Parker Ackley actually wrote about the Arisaka actions, and I don't think I still have his books around here. I used to have a set of Parker Ackley books that were like from the early days. Like, they had like denim bindings and stuff, and they were in really rough shape, and I read through them, and then I think I actually sold them to a guy that wanted to try to get them published online, because the books were just in really rough shape, and I didn't have a safe enough place to keep them, so I ended up selling those books. But it seems like I remember that Parker Ackley had wrote that the Arisaka actions were the strongest military actions at that time, you know, for bolt guns. And I seem to remember reading that after the war, he collected all the actions he could, you know, could get of various types, Mausers and Jap rifles and, you know, American, like the 03 A3s and all that kind of stuff. And he tried to blow them up and, you know, and measure the pressure it took to blow up each action. And if I remember correctly, the barrels would blow off the Arisaka actions or before off the Arisaka rifles before the action was actually give out. These rifles were built super tough. You know, they had good strong steel and they had top notch heat treating, and it makes them very strong for the most part, with the exception of those last ditch rifles, which we will talk about later. All right, so the Japanese, they adopted the 6.5 by 50 smokeless powder cartridge in 1897 for their Type 30 rifles, and then in 1905, they kind of revived and they adopted the Type 38 rifle for the same 6.5 by 50 Japanese cartridge. And oh, you know, with time going into war and that kind of stuff, you know, with World War One and all that, they found that the very mild, the 6.5 by 50 was a pretty mild cartridge, and they found that it left a lot to be desired in the power department. You know, when they were up against German 8mm Mausers and 303 Britishes and that kind of stuff, they found that their 6.5 was lacking in power. So the Japanese Imperial Navy was using the 303 British with the 7.7mm designation after World War One for their machine guns. And the Japanese Imperial Army, they set out to develop their own 7.7mm round using it, and they started with the Navy's ammo, which was basically a 303 British. I mean, it was, as far as I know, it's all like the same dimensions. It was just the same ammo. It was just called 7.7mm instead of 303. You know, and one thing about like the 303 British is that it uses the old way of measuring boards, where they actually measure the bore diameter, not the groove diameter, which is why it's a 303 British and not like a 311 British or whatever, because they use 311 diameter bullets. So, or like, you know, ours would be a 308, that's like 308 Winchester, that's the bore diameter or the groove diameter, but the British was all in bore diameter, and that's why it's a 303. So anyway, get off that little sidetrack. So the Japanese Imperial Army, they set out to develop their own 7.7 millimeter round, and there were several different rounds that they kind of adopted, but, you know, during development, you know, they started with the 303, and then they they took the rims off and they put a semi rim on for their machine guns, and they did a few different things, and they built guns for them and kind of adapted them. But their final product was the 7.7x58 rimless, and they put that in a Type 99 rifle, and that was adopted in 1939 as the Imperial Military Standard Rifle cartridge. And they were, going to swap out all of their rifles to that. All the 6.5s were getting to get traded in for the 7.7s. However, due to the need of rifles in the war, they did not fully swap over to the Type 99. Both the 6.5 and 7.7 rifles were both used extensively in World War II. Ballistically, the 7.7x58 Japanese cartridge is nearly identical to the 303 British, and very close to other military cartridges of that time, especially the 8x57 Mauser cartridge. The final version of the military ammo fired a 182 grain bullet at 2400 foot per second. Reloading data for the 7.7 Jap is listed in quite a few of the books I have. The 9th edition Hornady book shows the 7.7 Jap pushing a 150 grain at speeds ranging from 2200 to 2700 versus the same bullet at the same speeds in the 303 British. However, when you jump up to a 174 grain bullet, the Japanese round pulls ahead, with a little bit higher velocities. They also show load data for the 150 grain bullet in 8mm Mauser with velocity from 2400 to 2900 foot per second. And then just for comparison, the same book shows loads for the 308 Winchester with 150 grain bullets running from 2300 to 2800, and loads for the M1 Grand 30-06 with 150 grain bullets running from 2400 to 2750. So while the 7.7 Jap is not the hottest milsurp round out there, it is still a very viable hunting round, for most North American game, and it fell right in the middle of the road with all the other ones of that, of Second World War era. So while we are on the subject of the 7.7 Japanese ammo, before we move on to the rifle, I feel like I should mention this, and because I came across this a lot when I was reading about this, and it was very heavily recommended, so I went ahead and decided to go ahead and talk about this. And there were several military variants of the 7.7 Japanese ammo out there, and most of this ammo is marked and color-coded with like a lacquer around the case mouth, and it's colored, and tracers were marked with red. And if you come across these, the tracers, or they also had explosive and incendiary rounds, all of these are extremely unstable, and they are known to go off or explode if they are dropped or handled aggressively. So just to keep in mind, if you got some old 7.7 Jap ammo laying around and you come across some at a yard sale and it looks like tracers, be really, really careful with that stuff. Because it's apparently extremely unstable, especially as it gets older. So, since the cartridge was deprived from the 7.7 Imperial Navy round, also known as the 303 British, it is possible to fire the 303 British ammo from the gun from the Type 99 rifles if the rims are filed off. When Japanese General Onoda was finally when he finally surrendered in 1974 after hiding in the Philippines and refusing to believe that war was over, when he finally surrendered, he turned in a functioning Type 99 Arisaka rifle and over 500 rounds of ammo. And I seem to remember reading that this ammo was modified 303 British ammo that he had used, and he filed the rims off of them, and he used this modified 303 ammo for hunting and his guerrilla warfare when he ran out of his issued ammo, because he wasn't just hiding out in the woods. He was still technically fighting the war. He thought the war was still going on, and he was shooting at farmers and doing all kinds of crazy things. So I think I remember reading that the ammo that he turned in with the rifle at the end of the war, or when he surrendered in 1970, I think it was 1974, but I believe I remember reading that was modified 303 British ammo. And I have also heard of these rifles being used with 308 7.62 NATO ammo in places where the Japanese ammo is not readily available. And there is actually a video on YouTube. If you just punch in 7.7 by 58 Arisaka on YouTube, there's a video of a guy firing one of these Type 99 rifles with 308 Winchester ammunition. But I do not recommend doing that. I mentioned before, these rifles, the rifles themselves, they kind of gained a bad rep. And I believe this was due to the last-ditch war rifle. Because you got to remember, a lot of the guys that were experiencing these rifles, you know, during the war, at the end of World War II, they were picking up these, you know, last-ditch rifles, and they were horrendous. From, you know, I've never handled one, I've never seen one, but I've heard that they were worse than the end war last-ditch German KR, you know, the Kar 98s. And I've seen some of the late 98s, and those were not well-done rifles. So, to say that the Japanese rifles are worse, that's really saying something. So, yeah, so towards the end of the Second World War, the Japanese, they were turning out very poor quality rifles, you know, not, and many of them were not even being heat treated, and they're just prone to blowing up during firing because they have zero kind of heat treating, they're just mild steel. However, the Type 38 and the Type 99 are both built on the same action. And both Parker Ackley, I mentioned him, and the U.S. Army did pressure testing on receivers after the war, and they found the Arisaka action to be the strongest of any of the military bolt guns of that time. So while the Type 38 rifles were used during development of the 7.7 Japanese cartridge, it was decided that the heavier recoil and the larger cartridge would require a new rifle to be built instead of just converting all the old ones to shoot the 7.7. And I believe the actions between the Type 38 and the Type 99 are the same. And the configuration of the rifles were just different, you know, such as like most of the Type 99s are mostly short rifles. But I'm not actually 100% sure, but I believe the Type 38 and the Type 99s are the same basic action. So these Type 99 rifles, they were built in series, each series was 100,000 rifles. And there was I think 9 arsenals that built these rifles. So mine is a series 3 rifle built by the Nagoya Arsenal, I think that's how you say that. I don't know. I'm not a Japanese. I don't speak Japanese. I'm just reading the word. Anyway, mine is a Series 3 with a 4-digit serial number. So it's a fairly early rifle, considering they built about 3.5 million of these Type 99s during World War II and before World War II. So I believe mine was probably built before Japan decided to bomb Pearl Harbor and get involved with something they shouldn't have. They shouldn't have messed with. So, and you know, you talk to the collectors, and you know, from what I'm reading and stuff, like the early rifles were very nicely done rifles. You know, they didn't have tool marks. They were very well done rifles, and you know, they had a few features on them that made them really stand out, such as the Type 99. They had a built-in wire monopod that folded down from the forearm. They had fold-out anti-aircraft sights. And they actually had a dust cover that fit onto the bolt, and it kind of shrouded the entire action. You know, it went back and forth with the bolt, and then it covered the entire injection port to keep dirt and mud and grime and everything else out of these rifles. And then the early rifles had chrome-lined barrels and chrome-plated bolt heads. And I believe, I'm fairly positive mine is a chrome-plated bolt head and barrel on my rifle. So, and all these things I just mentioned, as World War II progressed and they needed rifles and they got more desperate for rifles during the war, and all those features just kind of started to get dropped off the rifle. And by the end, the last rifle were very crude. You know, they had fixed sights that were welded on, very rough machining, plain bolts. Even they had wooden butt plates and stuff like that. You know, they had, some of them had 2-piece stocks that were just held together with a band that was welded to the barrel to hold the stocks together. Like, they were just very, very, very crude. So, so most of the Arisaka rifles that were used by the Japanese, you know, Army, Navy, everybody, they have the chrysanthemum stamped on the top of the receiver ring. Most of the collectors just call this a mum, and it's because probably, I'm guessing, not because it's easier to say than chrysanthemum, but because it's easier to spell. Because, you know, we're talking online. That is a hard word to spell. It took me a couple tries to figure out how to spell it when I was writing the script for this episode. So, and this was a symbol showing ownership of the rifles by the Emperor of Japan. And after the war, when these rifles were turned over, as a sign of respect, all the mums were ground off for the rifles that were turned in. So rifles with intact mums, with the intact, you know, stampings, they're quite a bit more rare, and they are sought after by collectors. So mine has the mum, you know, defaced with this X out. It's still intact, and it's just like, it almost looks like somebody took a cutoff wheel from a Dremel and just lightly cut an X across it. And I talked to a couple different collectors, guys that are into the military surplus stuff, and they all said that they have never personally seen one that was ground out like that. So it's kind of hard to say where, but like, and if you look online, like I did a bunch of Google image searching and that kind of stuff, and most of them, it just looked like they took a angle grinder and just completely ground it off. So it's kind of neat to see it mostly intact. So, and then during the, I think I was reading, I forget where I read it at, but during the Korean War, some of these rifles were rechambered to .30-06 for the Korean troops so that they could use the American .30-06 ammo. And I've also heard of this chambering being done sporterizing. When they got here to the States, people would run a .30-06 Reamer into them to make it easier to get ammo and shoot them. But I don't think it would be very accurate, considering the 7.7 Jap uses the 311 diameter bullet. But, you know, I suppose it would be accurate enough for war. I mean, of course, if you hand loaded, you could either hand load .30-06 with the 311 bullets or cast bullets or whatever and fit the ammo to the gun. I mean, I also remember reading about some of these rifles being rechambered to 8x57, but I cannot remember who they were used by. And I don't think very many of them were converted to 8x57, but I want to say it was around 150,000 of them were converted to .30-06 to use in Korea. So the chambers on these rifles are they're pretty loose, and most military rifles have loose chambers, but I think these ones were kind of known for being exceptionally loose so that they would still function while very dirty. And I've never been to Japan, I've never been to the jungle, I've never been anywhere, but I guess they must have been very concerned about these rifles not functioning when they were dirty, because like they had the dust covers and all that kind of stuff, you know. And it's just anyway, so it was a concern from them. So, like, if you look in like cartridge conversion books or anything like that, they all say that to make cases from the .30-06, but there is a slightly smaller case head diameter of 0.465 inch on the .06, which is the American standard, you know, for 308, 6.5 Creedmoor, 22-250, 35 wheel, and they all use that 0.465 .30-06 case head. But the 7.7 Jap actually has a 0.471 diameter case head. So when you reform cases from .30-06, they will bulge slightly once they're fired, which isn't a big deal. It's just, they work. 8mm Mauser brass is actually closer with a head diameter of 0.469, but it will come up just a hair short once it's formed and fired. So I fired a little bit of the factory ammo that I have for the rifle loaded on PPU brand brass, and it seems to fit the chamber really well. There's no bulging or anything like that. So I think the chamber on this one is pretty good. And I can't, you know, the bore looks good, and I don't imagine that somebody would have put this much time and effort into a rifle that didn't shoot good. Somebody obviously spent a lot of time and effort on this gun, and if it had a bad chamber or a bad bore, I'm sure they would have fired it before in its military form, and they wouldn't have messed with putting this kind of work into this rifle if it, you know, wasn't good parts. So, anyway, so that about sums up all of my current knowledge on these rifles. You know, I'm super excited to get a chance to go out there and shoot this one. I'll have dies here for it shortly, and I'll be able to start reloading for it. And once I get the factory ammo that I have fired, I'll have about 80 pieces of brass to work with, you know, for load development and stuff. Hornady makes bullets in that 311, Sierra, Nosler. Pretty much everybody makes .311 inch bullets because there's so many rifles out there that use that. The 303 British, the 7.62x39, 7.62x54, you know, the 7.62, or I think the 7.65 Argentine actually used the 308, but there's a lot of metric military rifles that use the larger diameter bullets. So, yeah, so there's a lot of good bullets out there for hand loading, you know, and I haven't put this rifle on a bench yet, but, you know, just shooting offhand, so if I go all the way out to the end of the driveway, I can get 60 yards shooting past the side of the house out to my pistol berm out back where I shoot pistols at, and shooting 60 yards offhand, I can keep, you know, right around 2-inch groups with it offhand. So I have high hopes that it will be, you know, acceptably accurate. You know, if I can get this rifle to shoot 2 MOA with the iron sights off of the bench at 100 yards, I will be happy with that. The action is not drilled and tapped for a scope, and I have zero intention of putting a scope on it. I think the Williams peep sights are about perfect for what this rifle is in the 200 yards or so that I'll use it to. You know, that's practical range for the power of the rifle where I live. You know, and I really wish I knew the backstory and the history on this rifle, because, like I said, somebody obviously put a lot of time and effort into building this rifle. It's a really, really nice little rifle. And I'm hoping that the state, the VLM, they closed our caribou season for the unit south of me for the season. And normally it runs from like August until May, and they just August till March, with a little closure in the winter. But right now it's just closed, and is it possible that they will open it back up? And I'm really hoping that they do. And if they do, I'm actually going to go try to shoot a caribou with this gun out there where I go caribou hunting at. I can get within 200 yards in some of the wooded areas, and I think it'd be a great caribou rifle. And if I don't get to go caribou hunting with it this winter, I will. I'd still like to try to do a bear bait again this spring, and I think this would be a great rifle for sitting in a stand over a bear bait. All right, everyone. Well, that about does it for this week. Be sure to go follow me on Instagram and any other social media platforms and YouTube. Just punch the Shooter's Apprentice into the search bar, and I should pop right up. I'm on various gun forums. That's always been my handle for a while now, the Shooter's Apprentice. Like I always say, I try to keep Instagram mostly gun and outdoor related, but it does get like crossover posts from my personal Facebook sometimes. So you might see some stuff that's not all guns, but, you know, mostly the Instagram page, I try to keep it all guns. Again, you know, currently I'm not putting videos on YouTube, but I'm working on trying to get geared up to start doing that again. So, as always, if you guys have any comments or questions about the show or about anything else, feel free to email me at dansgunstuff@gmail.com. And you can also message the Facebook page, which is listed as the Shooter's Apprentice Podcast. And like I said, I'm doing something really different with the way I got my microphone and everything set up today. So you guys give me some feedback on how the audio quality sounds in this episode. You know, I can kind of usually get an idea of how it sounds when I'm editing. But it's nice to have some feedback from you guys out there to let me know if you prefer it the way I had it or if this is better. So, all that being said, I'm going to go ahead and get this one wrapped up. Thanks again, guys. I will see you again next week. Until then, stay safe out there, and don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Can't stand to hear the same old song, and I don't leave the highway long enough to bog down in the mud, 'cause I've got rambling fever in my blood. I caught this rambling fever long ago when I first heard